It occurred to me, said Archibald, the next time both of us were awake. I don't think we have anything like this.
We, meaning?
The modern post-reconstitution mathic world.
And this, meaning?
He held up his hands and gazed about in an are-you-blind sort of gesture. We were standing next to a table in an alcove on the ground floor, open to the cloister on one side. The floor of the cloister itself was covered with thousands of identical horn-shaped nine-sided tiles that had been joined together with machine-tool precision into a non-repeating double-spiral pattern that was giving me motion sickness just looking at it. I turned my back on this and looked at a loaf of bread that was resting on the table. This was so fresh that steam was gushing out of the end. Archibald, an infamous heel filcher, had already got to it. The loaf had been made by braiding several ropes of dough together in a non-trivial pattern that, I feared, had deep, not theoretical significance and was named after some Elkhuzgian saint.
I just don't think we have anything this ancient, this, well, fantastic,
Archibald continued through a crunchy mouthful of bread heel.
There's more than one way to be inviolate, I guess, I said, tearing off a hunk of bread and sitting down at the table, which inevitably was ancient and covered with precision-cut tiles of diverse exotic woods. You can simply stop being a math.
And thereby become exempt from sax.
Exactly.
But what kind of entity owns something for 4,000 years?
That's what I kept asking myself on Ekba.
Ah, so you have a head start on me, Fra Erasmus.
I guess you could think of it that way.
What conclusion have you reached?
I stalled for a while by chewing the bread, which was possibly the best I'd ever had.
That I don't care, I finally said. I don't need to know the bylaws, the org chart, the financial statements, the tedious history of the lineage.
Archibald was horrified.
But how can you not be fascinated by...
I am fascinated, I insisted. That's the problem. I am suffering from fascination burnout. Of all the things that are fascinating, I have to choose just one or two.
Here's a candidate,
announced Saman, who had crossed into the cloister from an adjoining court where, I inferred, reticulum access was to be had. He sat down next to me and laid his jijaw on the table. The screen was covered with the calculations I had noticed him doing on the plane.
Chronology,
he said.
According to Jules, the amount of time that has passed since the Daben Ernud embarked on his first intercosmic journey is 885.5 years.
Whose years?
Jessery asked, skittering down the stairs from his cell, homing in on the smell of the bread. He closed with it like a wrestler and ripped off a hunk.
That, of course, is the whole question,
Saman said, with a grin. Archibald noticed a pitcher of water on a sideboard and began pouring it out into earthenware tumblers incised with geometric patterns.
If Ernud years are anything like ours, that is a long time, I said.
Thank you, Fra Archibald.
The Ernudans, and later the Troans, wandered for a long time between advents. Jules thinks it explains why they are a little tetchy.
Can we get a conversion factor? Jessery said, in a tone that said, I'll be damned if I let this conversation wander.
That's what I've been working on, said Saman,
nodding thanks to Archibald. He took a draught of water. Elkhazg was in a climate that sucked the moisture out of you.
Problem is, Jules is a linguist, hasn't paid a lot of attention to this, knows the timeline in Ernud years, which is their standard unit up there, but not the conversion factor to Arb years. Anyway, I was able to back it out from some clues.
What clues? Jessery demanded.
While the rest of us were evacuating Tredegar, a unit of Veilers assaulted the quarters of the so-called Matarites, and captured a lot of documents and syndevs before the Ernud Trogais could destroy them. My brethren are still virtualizing the syndevs, never mind. But some of the documents have timestamps in Ernud units, which can be matched against recent events on our calendar.
Wait a moment, please. How can we even read a document in Ernudan?
Archibald asked, sitting down and helping himself to the other heel.
We can't. But a crypt analyst can easily see that many of the documents have the same format, which includes a string of characters readily decipherable as a timestamp. And they have a special phonetic alphabet for transliterating proper names. They haul it out and dust it off whenever they encounter a new planet. This, too, is elementary to decipher. So if we see a document that has the phonetic transcription of Jessery and of his Loctor at the plenary, we can infer it must be a report of the plenary I participated in after I came back from space, Jessery said. And we know the ARB date of that event. Very well. I agree that such givens would enable you to begin estimating a conversion factor relating Arbran to Ernewden years.
Yes,
said Saman.
And there is still some error margin, but I believe that in Arbran years, the Ernewdens began their intercosmic journey 910 years ago, plus or minus 20.
Somewhere between 890 and 930 years ago, I translated. But that was the limit of my arithmetical powers so early in the morning. Saman was glaring fiercely into my eyes, willing me to wake up a little faster, to go the next step. But mere calculation was not my strong suit, especially when I had an audience.
Between 2760 and 2800 AR,
said a new voice. Leo, coming across the cloister with Jules Verne Durand. These two did not look as if they had only just gotten up. I guessed Leo had been pumping the Lateran for information.
Yes, Saman said. The time of the third sack.
One of Magnath Forrell's staff came out with a huge bowl of peeled and cut-up fruit and began ladling it into bowls which we passed around. Jules tore off a piece of bread and began to eat it. This surprised me at first, since he could not derive any nutritional value from it, but I reasoned it would fill his stomach and make him feel less hungry.
Wait a second, Jessery said. Are you trying to develop a theory that there is a cause-and-effect relationship at work, that the Ernewdens began their journey because of events that took place here on Arb?
I'm just saying it is a coincidence that needs looking at, Saman said.
We ate and thought. I had a head start on the eating, so I briefed Jessery and Leo, as well as others who drifted in, such as three of the Veilers, on the conversations we had had in the Plurality of Worlds Messel about the Wick, and the idea that Arb might be the HTW of other worlds, such as Ernewd. The newcomers then had to be brought up to speed on the first part of this morning's conversation, so the conversation forked and devolved into a general hubbub for a couple of minutes.
So information could flow from Arb to Ernewd in that scenario, Jessery concluded,
loudly enough to shut everyone up and retake the floor.
But why would the third sack trigger such behavior on the part of an Ernewden star captain?
Fra Jessery, remember the margin of error that Saman was careful to specify,
Arcibald said.
The trigger could have been anything that happened in this cosmos in the four decades beginning around 2760. And I'll remind you that this would include
events leading up to the third sack, I blurted. Silence. Discomfort. Averted gazes. Except for Jules Verne Durand, who was staring right at me and nodding. I recalled his willingness to broach excruciating topics at Messel, and decided to draw strength from that. I'm done tiptoeing around this topic, I said. It all fits together. Fra Clothrund of Edhar was the tip of an iceberg. Others back then, who knows how many thousands, worked on a praxis of some kind. Prokians and Halicarnians alike. It's hard to know the truth of what this praxis was capable of. The parking ramp dinosaur hints at what it could do when they made mistakes. We know what the seculars thought of it, how they reacted. The records were destroyed, the practitioners massacred, except in the Three Inviolates. There's no telling what people like Fra Jad have been up to since then. I'll bet they've just been nursing it along.
Keeping the pilot light burning, Leo called.
Yeah, I said. But something about what they did, circa 2760 when the praxis reached its zenith, sent out a signal that propagated down the wick and was noticed, somehow, by the Theors of Ernewd.
It drew them here, you're saying,
said Leo.
Like a dinner bell.
Like the fragrance of this bread, I said.
Perhaps it's not just the smell of the bread that has drawn others to this room, Fra Erasmus,
Arcibald suggested.
Perhaps it is the sound of the conversation. Half-overheard words. Not understandable at a distance, but enough to pique the interest of any sentient person in range of the voices.
You're saying that's what it might have been like to the Ernudan Theors on that ship, I said, when they received, I don't know, emanations, hints, signals, percolating down the wick from Arb.
Precisely, said Arcibald.
We all turned to Jules. He had removed some Lateran food from a bag and, having sated his appetite with stuff he could not digest, was now eating a few bites of what his body could use. He noticed the attention, shrugged, and swallowed.
Do not hold your breath waiting for an explanation from the pedestal. Those of 900 years ago were rational Theors, to be sure. But during the long, dark years of their wandering, it became something better recognizable as a priesthood. And the closer these priests get to their god, the more they fear it.
I wonder if we might calm them down just a little bit by getting them to see they're not actually that close, Jessery said.
What do you mean? Arcibald asked.
Fra Jad's an interesting guy and all, Jessery said, but he doesn't seem like a god or even a prophet to me. Whatever it is that he's doing when he chants or plays Teglon all night, I don't think it is godlike. I think he's just picking up signals coming to Arb from farther up the wick.
By now, everyone had shown up and eaten except for Fra Jad. We found him sitting in the middle of the Decagon, eating some food that had been brought out to him by the staff. The Decagon looked altogether different. When we had passed across it yesterday, it had been paved in hand-sized clay tiles, dark brown and grooved, just like the ones I'd played with at Orathena, except proportionally smaller. The groove seemed to run unbroken from one vertex to the opposite. I had not taken the time to verify this, but I assumed it was a correct solution. For those who wanted to try their hands at it, baskets of white porcelain tiles, marked with black glazed lines instead of grooves, had been stacked all around the edges. This morning, though, the baskets were empty, and Fra Jad was enjoying his breakfast on a seamless white courtyard decorated with a wandering black line. During the night, he had tiled the whole thing. When we understood this, we burst into applause. Arcibald and Jessery were shouting as if at a ball game. The Veilers approached Fra Jad and bowed very low. Out of curiosity, I backtracked to the outskirts of the Decagon and stepped off its edge, for the surface was several inches higher than the adjoining pavement. I squatted down and lifted up one of Jad's white tiles to expose a small patch of brown tiling underneath. Jad's was, as I'd expected, a wholly different solution of the Teglon. The positions of the older brown tiles didn't match up with those of the new ones, proving that Fra Jad had not merely copied the older solution.
It is the fourth, said a gentle voice.
I looked up to find Magnath Forel watching me. He nodded at the tile in my hand. Looking more closely at the edge of the Decagon, I perceived now that underneath the brown tiles was a layer of green ones, and below that, one of terracotta.
Well, I said, I guess you need to bake up a new set of tiles.
Forel nodded and said, deadpan,
I don't think there is any great hurry.
I set the white tile back into its place, stood up, and took a step up to the Decagon. It was open to the sky. I craned my neck and looked straight up.
Think they noticed? I asked.
Magnath Forel got a bemused look and said nothing. Cell 317 moved on to convene in a courtyard we had not visited yesterday. This one was circular and roofed by a living bower. They had somehow trained half a dozen enormous flowering vines to arch across the top of the space and grapple with one another to form a stable dome of interlocked branches 50 feet above the ground. Dappled light shone through it to illuminate the cool space below, but seen from above, it would look like a hemisphere of solid green, freckled with color. Pallets of mysterious but expensive-looking stuff had been stationed around the edge of the yard. We devoted the remainder of the morning to breaking these open, getting rid of packaging materials, and drawing up an inventory, mindless labor that everyone badly needed. That we'd be going into space was obvious from the nature of this stuff. By weight, it was 99% containers. We were opening beautiful 20-pound lockers to find pieces of equipment that weighed as much as dried flowers. we shed our bolts and cords in favor of nearly weightless charcoal-gray coveralls.
"It's all for the best," Jessery said, eyeing me. "In zero gravity, the bolt doesn't hang, if you get my meaning. Things would get ugly fast."
"Speak for yourself," I said. "Anything else I need to know?"
"If you get sick, which you will, it'll last for 3 days. After that, you get better or you get used to it. I'm not sure which."
"Do you think we'll even have 3 days?"
"If they were only sending us up as a diversion..."
"Just to get killed, you mean?"
"Yeah. Then they could just send Prokians."
Our conversation had begun to draw in others, such as the Veilers, who did not understand Jessery's sense of humor. He cleared his throat and called out,
"What is happening, my fraw?"
to Leo. Leo sprang to the top of a tarp-covered pallet, and everyone went silent.
"We're not allowed to know yet what the mission is,"
he began,
"or why we're doing it. We just have to get there."
"Get where?" I demanded.
"That Dabin Ernud," Leo said.
Not that we hadn't been paying attention, but we were really paying attention now. Everyone seemed brighter, especially Jules.
"Food, here I come."
"How are we going to get aboard a heavily armed—"
Arcibald began to ask.
"We haven't been told that yet," Leo said, "which is just fine because simply getting off the ground is difficult enough. We can't use the normal launch sites. I would presume that the pedestal have threatened to rob them if they noticed launch preparations. That means we can't use the usual rockets because those are tailor-made to be launched only from those sites. And that in turn means we can't use the usual space vehicles, such as the one you rode on, Jessery, because those can only be launched by said rockets. But there is an alternative. During the last big war, a family of ballistic missiles was developed. They use storable propellants, and they launch from the backs of vehicles that ramble around the countryside on treads."
"That can't work,"
Jessery protested.
"A ballistic missile doesn't get its payload to orbit. It merely throws a warhead at the other side of the world."
"But suppose you take off that warhead and replace it with something like this,"
Leo said. He jumped down, got a grip on the tarp, collected himself and snapped it away with a forceful movement of the hips and the arms. Revealed was a piece of equipment not a great deal larger than a major household appliance.
"A gazebo on top of a welding rig," was how Yule might have described it, if only he had been here.
The gazebo was a very small one, though, as Leo demonstrated, it was large enough to house one person in a fetal position. Its roof was a lens of pressed sheet metal with some sort of hard coating. It was supported by four legs, spindly-looking triangulated struts like miniature radio towers. So the gazebo had a roof and pillars, but it lacked a floor. In lieu of that were only three lugs projecting inwards from a structural ring. At the moment, these were spanned by a sheet of plywood which supported Leo's back as he curled up on top of it. Once he rolled out, though, he took the plywood away to reveal nothing below except for structural members and plumbing. There were two big tanks, a torus encircling a sphere, and several smaller ones, all spherical and none larger than what you'd see on the shelves of a sporting goods store. These were profoundly ensnared in plumbing and cable harnesses. Sticking out the bottom like an insect stinger was a rocket nozzle, dismayingly small.
"The real one will have a nozzle skirt bolted onto it," Leo informed us. "As big again as this whole stage."
"Stage?"
Simon exclaimed.
"You mean as in..."
"Yes," said Leo. "That's what I'm trying to tell you. I'm sorry I wasn't clearer. This is the upper stage of a rocket. There's one for each of us."
Then, so that we could get a better view of the nozzle, he grabbed a strut with one hand and hauled up. The entire stage rocked back, exposing the underside.
"You've got to be kidding," I exclaimed,
and put my hand next to his and shouldered him out of the way. He let it drop into my hand. The entire stage weighed considerably less than I did. Then everyone else had to try it.
"Where's the rest of it?"
Jessery asked. There was an awkward silence.
"This is the whole thing,"
proclaimed Jules Verne-Durand, understanding it perfectly, even though he was seeing it for the first time.
"The conception is magnifique."
Well, since you appear to be an expert on Monyafiks, Jessery said, maybe you could tell us how four legs and a roof are going to contain a pressurized atmosphere.
It's not called a Monyafik, Leo protested mildly. It's a, oh, never mind.
We will have only spacesuits, am I right?
Jules asked, looking to Leo. Leo nodded.
Jules gets it. Since we need spacesuits anyway, complete with life support and sanitation and all the rest, it'd be redundant to send up a pressurized capsule comprising extra copies of the same systems.
I was expecting Jessery to lodge further protests, but he underwent a sudden conversion and held up both hands to silence murmurs.
I have been there, he reminded us, and I can tell you there is no part of the shared space capsule experience I'm eager to relive. You don't know the meaning of nasty until you've been blindsided by a drifting blob of someone else's vomit. Don't even get me started on what passes for toilets. How hard it is to see out those tiny windows. I think this is a great idea. Each of us sealed up in our own personal spaceship, keeping our farts to ourselves, enjoying the panoramic view out the face mask.
How long is it possible to live in a spacesuit? I asked.
You're going to love this, Jessery proclaimed, taking the floor with a nod from Leo.
Jessery strode over to where he, with help from Frog Gratho, had, for the last hour or so, been assembling spacesuits. He approached one that seemed to be complete and slapped a green metal canister socketed into the suit's backpack.
Liquid oxygen. A whole 4 hour supply right here.
Provided you show discipline in its use, put in Survey.
Liquid, as in cryogenic? Simon asked. Of course. How long will it stay cold?
In space, it's not such an issue. It'll stay cold as long as the fuel cell has fuel to run the chiller.
Slapping a red canister, he went on.
Liquid hydrogen. Easy on, easy off.
He twisted it off, showed us some kind of complicated latching gasket hardware, then twisted it back on.
So we're competing against a fuel cell for the available oxygen?
Arcibald asked.
Think of it as cooperation.
What about waste products?
Someone asked. But Jessery was ready.
Carbon dioxide is scrubbed here.
He twisted off a white can and waved it around.
When it's used up, slap on a new one. Then, oh, you'll like this, take the old one over to the tender.
He paced over to a separate piece of equipment that looked as if it belonged to the same genus but a different species from the spacesuits. It had color-coded sockets all over it for tanks and canisters. He jacked the scrubber onto one of these.
It bakes the CO2 out of the scrubber. When this bar has changed color,
he pointed to an indicator on the side of the can.
It's ready to use again.
This device is also a reservoir of air and fuel?
Asked Survey, eyeing the sockets for oxygen and hydrogen canisters.
If it's available, this is where you'll get it, Jessery said. It's meant to be connected to a water bladder and an energy supply, usually solar panels, but in our case, a little nuke. It breaks the water down into hydrogen and oxygen, liquefies them, and fills any tank you slap onto it. And it uses heat to recycle the scrubbers, as I was saying. Likewise, when your waste bags fill up, we'll discuss those later. You attach them here,
pointing fastidiously to an array of yellow fittings.
Do you mean to say we'll be defecating inside the suits?
Arcibald asked.
Thank you for volunteering to demonstrate this amazing feature of the Praxis,
Jessery proclaimed.
Leo and Raz, would you be so kind as to give your Fra some privacy?
Leo and I collected Arcibald's bolt from where he had left it and held it up, stretched between us, to make a screen as Arcibald shed his coverall. Meanwhile, Jessery fetched a double extra-large spacesuit and trundled it over. It was suspended from a rolling contraption that he called the Dawning Rig. The suit consisted of a big rigid construct, the head and torso unit, or, inevitably, HTU, whose upper back hinged open like a refrigerator door. Each arm and each leg was built up out of several short, stiff, bulbous pods, stacked like beads on a string. This gave it a different appearance from the spacesuits I remembered seeing in Spiele's and on the Warden of Heaven. This one was bigger, more rounded, reassuringly solid. Another big difference, at least cosmetically, was that this suit like all of the others that Jessery had been working on, was matte black. Arcibald stepped toward the donning rig, raising his hands to grasp a strategically located chin-up bar, and pulling, climbing to a step poised at the threshold of the suit's back door. He was surprisingly game. Perhaps he was remembering spec-fix spielies he used to watch before he was collected, or perhaps he just didn't like being naked. With some help from Jessery, he introduced one pointed toe, then the other, into the leg holes at the base of the HTU, and lowered himself into them. As his feet descended, the hard segments rotated in different ways. Each bulb, it seemed, was joined to its neighbors by an airtight bearing. All of them could rotate independently so that elbows and knees could bend normally, without the need for a complex joint mechanism. Arcibald looked even more roly-poly than usual now. He flexed one leg, then the other, giving us a look at how the segments allowed movement by rotating against each other.
"I want you to take notice of the bags ringing your thighs and waist," Jessery said, indicating some rubberish-looking stuff hanging limp from the inner walls of the HTU. "In a few minutes, those are going to rock your world."
"It is so noted,"
Arcibald said, thrusting one hand, then the other, into the arm constructs, which seemed to end in blunt hemispherical domes, handless stumps. All we could see now was his back and his arse. Jessery did us all the favor of slamming the door on that. Now that our fra was decent, Leo and I let the bolt drop, then migrated round to Arcibald's front side. We could barely hear his muffled voice. Jessery jacked a wire into a socket on the chest and turned on an amplifier. We heard Arcibald on a speaker.
"There's much for my hands to learn about down here. I wish I could see what I was doing."
"We'll go over it," Jessery promised.
He spoke distractedly, since he was busy examining an array of readouts on the front of the suit, making sure his fra wasn't going to asphyxiate in there. I noticed others staring at Arcibald's front and looking amused, so I came around to that side of him and discovered that a small, flat-panel spiele screen was planted in the middle of his chest. It was showing a live feed of Arcibald's face, taken by a spiele captor inside the helmet. It was quite distorted because shot through a fisheye lens at close range, but gave us something to look at other than the opaque, smoked glass face mask.
"Pray tell, what are all these nozzles in front of my mouth?"
Arcibald asked, eyes downcast and scanning.
"Left, water, right, food, and, as warranted, pharmaceuticals. The big one in the middle is the scupper."
"The what?"
"You throw up into it. Don't miss."
"Ah."
Arcibald's eyes rose to look out the face mask at where his hands ought to have been. He raised one arm until its stump was up where he could see it. A hatch popped open. We all jumped back as something like a giant metal spider sprang out of it, flailing its limbs. On a second look, this proved to be a skeletal hand. Bones, joints, and tendons mimicking those of a natural hand, but all made of machined, black anodized metal, and skinless, unless you counted the black rubber pads on the tips of the fingers. It all grew out of a wrist joint that was fixed to the end of the stump. At first, it twitched and flopped spasmodically. One by one, the joints seemed to come under Arcibald's control, and it began to move like a real hand. His other arm came up, the hatch popped open, and another hand emerged from it. This one, though, was less human-looking. It was studded with small tools.
"Explain what you were doing with your hands," I requested. "The ends of the arms are roomy," Arcibald said. "There is a sort of glove into which I can insert my hand. It is mechanically connected to the skeletal hand that you can all see."
"Pure mechanism?" Saman asked. "No servos?"
"Strictly mechanical," said Jessery. "See for yourself."
And we gathered round for a closer look. The skeleton hand was animated by a number of metallic ribbons and pushrods that all disappeared into the arm stump where, we gathered, they were connected directly to the internal glove that Arcibald was wearing.
"Simple, in a way,"
was Fra Osa's verdict.
"Yet very complex."
"Yes, except for the airtight seals. The whole thing could have been made by a medieval artisan with a lot of time on his hands," Jessery said. "Fortunately, the mathic world has a large number of medieval artisans. And believe it or not,
It's easier to build something like this than it is to make a pressurized spacesuit glove that's actually good for anything.
There are other controls as well in the end of the stump,
Arcibald volunteered.
If I withdraw my hand from the glove...
The Skellahan twitched, flopped, and went limp. It snapped back into its storage compartment in the end of the stump, and the hatch closed over it.
Now,
Arcibald said,
I'm groping around on the inner surface of the stump, which is replete with all manners of buttons and switches. Be careful with those,
Jessery suggested.
Most of the suit's functions are controlled by voice commands, but there are manual overrides that you don't want to mess with. How are we to tell all of these buttons and whatnot apart since we can't see them?
Arcibald asked. And on the Speely screen, we could see his eyes wandering around uselessly as he felt his way around the inside of the stump.
Most of them are a keyboard for entering alphanumeric data with the fingertips. Saman will be able to use it immediately. The rest of us will have to hunt and peck.
So, I asked, overall, what do you think? How does it feel?
Surprisingly comfortable.
As you've noticed, the suit touches you in relatively few places, Jessery said.
That is for comfort, and so that your core temp can be regulated by a simple air conditioning system. Obviates the tube garment that the Ward of Heaven had to wear. But where it touches you, it really grabs you. Say the words, sanitary elimination cycle commence. Sanitary elimination cycle commence,
Arcibald repeated, with trepidation rising as he climbed to the end of this ungainly phrase. The words sanitary elimination cycle appeared on a status panel below the spiele of his face. His eyes got wide.
Oh my God,
he exclaimed. Everyone laughed.
Care to explain what's going on?
Jessery said.
Those airbags you pointed out to me earlier, they inflated around my waist and upper thighs.
Your pelvic region is now completely isolated from the rest of the suit, Jessery said.
I'll say.
You can do whatever needs doing.
I believe we can skip that part of the demonstration, Fraud Jessery.
Have it your way. Say, sanitary elimination cycle conclude. Arcibald said it, and we got to have another laugh as we saw and heard his reaction.
I'm being sprayed with warm water, fore and aft.
Yes, boys and girls get the same treatment, like it or not, Jessery said. Jessery now hauled down a thick hose that was part of the donning rig and jacked it into a not very dignified part of the suit's anatomy.
We don't have the infinite vacuum of space to draw on, so we fake it.
He hit a switch and a vacuum cleaner howled for several seconds.
More comedy on the Speely screen.
Arcibald informed us that he was now being vigorously air-dried. Then,
it's over. The bag's deflated.
We know,
Saman said, reading the status panel.
You spend some air every time you do this, so use it sparingly,
Jessery cautioned us.
But the point is, as long as the tender is up and running, we can live in these things for a long time, I said.
Yeah.
This suit is altogether different from that worn by the Warden of Heaven,
Fra Osa pointed out.
More sophisticated.
Beautifully machined, I said, wishing Cord could be here to admire the huge ring bearing that encircled Arcibald's waist just below the threshold of the back door, making it possible for him to swivel his hips and shoulders independently.
It is literally unbelievable,
was Arcibald's verdict.
As highly as I rate our Fras and Sewers of the Convox, I can't believe they could have designed something of such complexity on such short notice.
They didn't,
Jessery said.
This suit was designed, down to the last detail, 26 centuries ago.
For the big nugget?
Saman asked.
Exactly. And that Convox had several years to devote to it. The plans were achieved at St. Rab's and preserved during the Third Sack by Fras and Sewers, who carried the books around on their backs their whole lives. Last year, when the geometers dropped into orbit around Arb, there was a whole round of Vokos that we at Edhar never heard about, just to dump talent into restarting the program. Money was spent on an inconceivable scale to build these. He slapped Arcibald's shoulder. And those, he waved at the Monyafik. Note the attachment points.
He swiveled Arcibald around so that the rest of us could see his back and pointed out a triangular array of sockets in the same configuration as the structural lugs on the Monyafik. One plugs into the other. They become an integrated unit. So we don't need furniture. No acceleration couches. Airbags in the suit will inflate to cushion our bodies during launch.
Impressive,
Saman said.
The only thing we won't be able to do in these things is sneak around.
Everyone looked at him blankly. He grinned and waved at Archibald's chest, all lit up with spiely feeds, alphanumeric displays, and status lights.
Pretty much rules out a covert operation.
Gratho stepped forward, grabbed a barely noticeable ridge projecting from the HTU at collarbone level, and pulled down. A retractable black screen deployed, slid down, and latched in place just above the waist bearing. All of the lights and displays were now concealed. Archibald was matte black from head to toe, as if he'd been sculpted out of damp carbon.
It is remarkable, Ossa pointed out. When one considers that these were not even available when you, Fra Jesri, went up with the Warden of Heaven.
Jesri nodded.
There are now 16 of them.
But there are 11 of us,
Archibald exclaimed over his speaker. We'd forgotten he was there. His skele-hand groped at his waist, found the latch for the screen and yanked it back up to expose the spiele. His familiar look of bulging-eyed surprise was comically magnified.
That's right, said Jesri.
The significance of that should be obvious,
Leo said.
But I will spell it out. We can't screw this up. It is a similar story with the missile launchers. These were a military secret. There's no reason why the pedestal, who have obtained almost all of their knowledge of ARB from the leakage of popular culture into space, would know of their existence. They were specifically made to be hard to see from above, but as soon as one of them is launched, his thermal signature will be picked up on the geometer surveillance, and they'll know all about them. So they must be launched all at once or not at all. There are a couple of hundred. They're all going to be sent up within the same 10-minute launch window, which happens to be 3 days from now. 11 of them will be tipped with Magnifiques, carrying the members of this cell. Quite a few others will carry the equipment and consumables we'll be needing.
And the remainder?
Saman asked. Leo said nothing, though he did throw a glance at me. Both of us were thinking of the everything killers.
Decoys and chaff,
he said finally.
What is it we're expected to do once we get up there?
Archibald asked.
Consolidate a number of other payloads into a thrust platform. I won't dignify it as a vehicle. That will inject us into a new orbit,
Leo said.
An orbit that will bring us to a rendezvous with the Dabin Ernud.
We could have guessed that much,
Jesri said.
What Fra Archibald is really asking is...
Fra Ossa stepped forward, giving Leo an if-I-may look. We hadn't heard much out of the Veil Leader, so everyone got where they could see him.
The greatest difficulty for one such as you shall be not completion of the given tasks, but instead the humiliation and uncertainty that arises from not being able to know the entire plan. These emotions can hamper you. You must simply decide now, either to proceed with the awareness that the entire plan might never be revealed to you, and, were it revealed, might have obvious defects, or to turn away and allow some other person to occupy the spacesuit that has been allotted to you.
And then he stepped back. There was a minute of silence as all of us made our decisions, if that was the right word for what was going on in our heads. I didn't feel any of the emotions connected with real decision-making. To step away from this group at the moment was simply unthinkable. There was no decision to be made. Fra Ossa, who had devoted his entire life to preparing for such situations, no doubt knew this perfectly well. He wasn't really asking us to make a decision. He was telling us, in a reasonably diplomatic way, to shut up and concentrate on the matter at hand. And so that is what we did 18 hours a day until the Drummond came to pick us up and take us out to the airfield. Though a casual observer might have thought we were working only half the time and playing video games otherwise, three of the cells that adjoined the courtyard had been equipped with syndevs hooked to big wraparound spiele screens. In the center of each was a chair with disembodied spacesuit arms rigged to it. We'd take turns sitting in that chair with our hands stuck into the arms, groping at the controls.
Projected on the screens around us was a simulation of what we might see out our face masks when we were floating around in low orbit, complete with all manner of readouts and indicators that, we were promised, would be superimposed on the view by the suit's built-in syndevs. The controls beneath our fingertips could be patched through to the thrusters on the Monufix, so that once we reached orbit, we'd be able to scoot around and accomplish certain tasks. Beneath the left hand was a little sphere that spun freely in a cradle. Beneath the right, a mushroom-shaped stick that could be moved in four directions as well as pushed down or pulled up. The former controlled the suit's rotation, which was pretty easy to manage. The latter controlled translation, moving across space as opposed to spinning in place. That would be tricky. Things in orbit didn't behave like what we were used to. Just to name one example, if I were pursuing another object in the same orbit, my natural instinct would be to fire a thruster that would kick me forward. But that would move me into a higher orbit, so the thing I was chasing would soon drop below me. Everything we knew down here was going to be wrong up there. Even for those of us who had learned orbital mechanics at Orlo's feet, the only way for us to really grasp it was by playing this game.
"It is deceptive,"
was Jules' observation. He and I were in one of those cells together. I'd become good early at playing the game since I knew the underlying theorics, so helping others learn it had become my role.
"The gorash at the left hand seems to make a great effect."
He spun the little sphere. I closed my eyes and swallowed as the image on the screens, consisting of Arb and some other stuff in orbit around us, snapped around wildly.
"However, in truth, the six elements have not been changed in the slightest."
He was referring to the row of six numbers lined up across the bottom of the simulated display. The same six numbers I'd once taught Barb about in the refectory kitchen.
"That's right," I said. "You can spin around all you want and it won't change your orbital elements, which is all that really matters."
A six-way indicator in the lower right began to flicker, which told me that Jules was using his other hand, the Dexter, as he called it, to play with the mushroom, which he called a joystick. The six orbital elements began to fluctuate. One of them changed from green to yellow.
"Aha," I said. "You just screwed up your inclination. You're out of plane now."
"Very significant in the long run," he said. "And yet, deceptively, I observe no great difference now."
"Exactly. Let me run it forward, though, to show you what happens."
I had an instructor's control panel, which I used to fast-forward the simulation, compressing the next half hour into about 10 seconds. The other satellites drifted so far away from us that they were lost to sight.
"Once you get so far away that you can't see your friends or can't tell them apart from all of the decoys..."
"I am perdu," he said flatly.
"Can you make it run backward?"
"Of course." I ran the simulation back to just after he had messed up his inclination.
"How can I fix it? Like so, perhaps?"
he muttered, and tried something with the joystick. The inclination got a little worse, and the eccentricity jumped through yellow to red.
"Merde," he said.
"I am fouled up now on two of the six."
"Try the reverse of what you just did," I suggested. He fired the opposite thruster, and the eccentricity improved, but semi-major axis got worse.
"Quite a fine puzzle," he said. "Why did I study linguistics instead of celestial mechanics? Linguistics got me into this excellent mess. Only physics can get me out."
"What's it like up there?" I asked him. He was getting frustrated, and I thought he might benefit from a break.
"Oh, you have seen the model, I am sure. It is quite accurate in the externals which can be viewed by your telescopes. Of course, most of the 40,000 never see any of that. Only the internals of the orb stack where they live their whole lives."
He was speaking of the living heart of the Dabinernud. 16 hollow spheres, each a bit less than a mile in diameter, clustered about a central axis that rotated to produce pseudo-gravity.
"That's what I'm asking about," I said. "What's that community of 10,000 Laterans like?"
"Split now, between the fulcrum and the pedestal."
The fulcrum was the opposition movement, led by the Phthosians.
"But in normal times?"
"Until we came here, and the positions of pedestal and fulcrum became so hard,
It was like a nice provincial town with perhaps a university or research lab. Each orb is half full of water. The water is covered with houseboats. On the roofs of them, we grow our own food.
Oh, I remember food. Each race has four of the orbs, I assume.
Officially, yes, but there is, of course, some mixing of the communities. When the ship is not under acceleration, we can open certain doors to join neighboring orbs, and one moves freely between them. In one of the orbs of La Terre, we have a school.
So there are children.
Of course we have children, and raise them very well. Education is everything to us.
I wish we did a better job of that on Arb, I said. Extramuros, that is. Jules thought about it and shrugged.
Understand, I do not describe a utopia. We do not educate the young ones purely out of respect for noble ideals. We need them to stay alive and to allow the voyaging of the Daban Ernud to continue. And there is competition between the children of Ernud, Tro, Laterre, and Phthos for the positions of power within the command.
Does that even extend to fields such as linguistics? I asked.
Yes, of course. I am a strategic asset. To make its way to new cosmi and to carry out new advents is the raison d'etre of the command. And almost nothing is more useful to them in an advent than a linguist.
Of course, I said. So your nice town of 10,000 is big enough for people to marry, or
whatever you do, we marry, he confirmed. Or at least sufficient of us do and have children to maintain 10,000.
Well, how about you? I asked.
Are you married?
I was, he said. So they had divorces too.
Any kids?
No, not yet. Never now.
We'll get you back home, I told him.
Maybe you'll meet someone new up there.
Not like her, he said.
Then he got a wry look and shrugged.
When Lise and I were together, I always would have said such things. Sweet nothings. Oh, there is no one like you, my love.
He sniffled and looked away.
Not insincerely, of course. Of course not. But the manner of her passing made so clear, so bright, the truth of it, that there truly was no one like her. And in a community of only 10,000, cut off forever from its roots in the home cosmos, well, I know them all, Raz. All the women of my age. And I can tell you, as a matter of fact, that in the cosmos where you and I are standing, there is no one like my Lise.
Tears were running freely down his face now.
I am terribly sorry, I said.
I feel such a fool. I didn't understand your wife was dead.
She is dead, he confirmed. I have, you know, seen the pictures of her body, her face. All over the convox.
My God, I exclaimed. I wasn't in the habit of using religious oaths, but could think of nothing else strong enough.
The woman in the probe at Orathena. She was my Lise, said Jules Verne Durand. My wife. I have already told Saman.
And then he broke down altogether. Jules and I were sitting together in the darkened cell, nothing to see by except simulated sunlight, reflecting from a simulated orb and a simulated moon. Simulated persons in spacesuits drifted silently about us. He was hunched over, sobbing. I remembered our messal conversations about how we could interact in simple physical ways with the geometers, even if biological interaction was not possible. I went over and wrapped my arms around the Lateran until he stopped crying.
He told me, I said to Saman later. He knew immediately who and what I was speaking of. He broke eye contact and shook his head.
How's he doing?
Better. He said something good.
What's that?
I touched Orlo. Orlo touched Lise. Gave himself up for her. When I touched Jules, it was like
closing a cycle.
Yeah. I told him how we had prepared her body, the respect we showed it. He seemed to like hearing that.
He told me on the plane, Saman said. Asked me not to tell the others.
You have anyone like that, Saman? For in all the time we had spent together, we had never broached such topics. He chuckled and shook his head.
Like that? No. Not like that. A few girlfriends sometimes. Otherwise, just family. Ita are, well, more family-oriented.
He stopped awkwardly. The contrast with Avout was too obvious.
Well, in that vein, I finally said, could you help me close another cycle?
He shrugged.
Be happy to try. What do you need?
You got a message off to Ayla the other day, just before the plane took off. I was sort of shy.
Because of the lack of privacy, he said. Yeah, I could see that.
Can you send her another?
Sure. But it won't be any more private than the last.
I sort of chuckled.
Yeah. Well, considering everything, that'll be acceptable.
Okay. What do you want me to tell Ayla?
That if I get to have a fourth life, I want to spend it with her.
Phew,
he exclaimed, and his eyes glistened as if I had slapped him.
Let me type that in before you change your mind.
All we do now is go forward, I said.
There'll be no changing of minds.
Rod. Military slang. To bombard a target, typically on the surface of a planet, by dropping a rod of some dense material on it from orbit. The rod has no moving parts or explosives. Its destructiveness is a consequence of its extremely high velocity. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
I spent the entire journey to orbit convinced that the rocket had failed and that this was what dying was like. The designers hadn't had time or budget to put in fripperies like windows or even spiely feeds. Just a fairing, a thin outer shell whose functions were to shield the Monufique from wind blast, to block out all light, ensuring we'd make the trip in absolute darkness and ignorance, and to vibrate. The latter two functions combined to maximize the terror. Think of what you'd feel going down whitewater in a barrel. Keeping that in mind, think of being nailed into a rickety crate and then thrown from an overpass onto an 8-lane freeway at peak traffic. Now think of putting on a padded suit and being used for stick-fighting practice in the ringing veil. Finally, imagine having giant speakers glued to your skull and pure noise pumped into them at double the threshold for permanent hearing loss. Now, pile all of those sensations on top of each other and imagine them going on for 10 minutes. The only favorable thing I could say about it was that it was much better than how I'd spent the preceding hour, lying on my back in the dark, wedged and strapped in a fetal position, and expecting to die. Compared to that, actually dying was turning out to be a piece of cake. Most unpleasant, and in retrospect, most embarrassing, had been the philosophical musings with which I had whiled away the time. That Orlo's death and Lisa's had prepared me to accept my own. That it was good I had sent that message to Ayla. That even if I died in this cosmos, I might go on living in another. A stowaway hit me in the spine with a pipe. No, wait a second. That was the engine exploding. No, actually, it had been the explosive charges blowing off the fairing. A system of cracks split the darkness into quadrants, then expanded to crowd it out. The four petals of the fairing fell aft, and I found myself looking down at Arb. Some of the buffeting's overtones, aero-turbulence, lessened. Others, combustion chamber instability, got worse. The acceleration so far had not been a big deal compared to the buffeting. But about then it became quite intense for half a minute or so as the missile's engine concluded its burn. Made it hard to appreciate the view. Another spine crack told me that the booster had fallen off. Good riddance. It was just me and the Monufique now. A few moments, drift and weightlessness came to a decisive end as the steering thrusters got a grip and snapped the stage into the correct orientation with a crispness that was reassuring, even if it did make some of my internal organs swap places. Then a sense of steadily building weight as the Monufique's engine came on for its long burn. To all appearances, the sky was black. I was out of the atmosphere, and the roof of the gazebo was doing nothing more than blocking my view ahead. But as the Monufique's engine pushed me ahead toward orbital velocity, Blades of plasma grew out from the roof's edges and twitched around my shoulders and feet, just close enough to make it interesting. This was the upper atmosphere being smashed out of the way with such violence that electrons were being torn loose from atoms. At the launch site, just after I'd swallowed the big pill, an internal temperature transponder, and donned the suit, the Avowed who'd been pressed into service as launch crew had mummified me in kitchen wrap, stuffed me into the gazebo, bracing their shoulders against the soles of my feet, and strapped me together with packing tape. They had taken measurements with yardsticks, freebies from the local megastore. More tape work had ensued until they had compressed me into an envelope that matched the diagrams on their hastily printed, extensively hand-annotated documents. Then they had converged on me with cans of expanding foam insulation and foamed me into position, being sure to get the stuff between my knees and my chest, my heels and my butt, my wrists and my face. Once the foam had become rigid, someone had reached in and peeled the plastic back from my face shield so that I could see, patted me on the helmet, and stuck a box cutter into my hand. The importance of the measurements became obvious during the early minutes of the second stage burn, as I saw those jets of white-hot atmosphere playing within inches of my feet. But they faded as we climbed out of the atmosphere altogether. The entire gazebo sprang off, literally it was spring-loaded, and drifted away, leaving me as hood ornament. Then I was powerfully tempted to get free of the packing material, but I knew the velocity versus time curve of this trajectory by heart and knew I was still far from reaching orbital velocity. Most of the velocity gain was going to happen in the final part of the burn, when the Magnifique had left in its wake 3/4 or more of its mass in the form of expended propellants. The same thrust, pushing against a greatly reduced burden, would then yield acceleration that Leo had cheerfully described as near fatal.
"It's okay," he'd said. "You'll black out before anything really bad happens to you."
I tried to look around. During the last 3 days, I had fantasized that the view would be fantastic, inspiring. I'd be able to see the other rockets going up, 200 of them, all arcing up and east on roughly parallel courses. But the suit had more airbags inside of it than Jesri had let on, and all of them had been pumped up to maximal inflation, meaning I was lying on a bed of rocks. Locking my head and torso into the attitude deemed least likely to end in death, paralysis, or organ failure. My spleen could rest easy. My eyes could see nothing but a star field, and a bit of Arb's glowing blue atmosphere down in the lower right. Those grew blurry as my eyes began to water, and the eyeballs themselves were mashed out of shape by their own weight, like Archibald sitting on a water balloon. I was falling. I was hung over. I was not dead. My suit was talking to me. Had been for a bit.
"Issue the restraint depressurize command to deflate the restraint system and to commence the next stage of the operation," suggested a voice in Orth, over and over.
Some sewer with good enunciation who'd been drafted to read canned messages into our recording device. I wanted to meet her.
"Rosin Zazal,"
I said, thinking that this would impress her. The suit drew breath, then said,
"Issue the restraint depressurize command to..."
"Rosin Depla,"
I insisted. She was beginning to get on my nerves. Maybe I didn't want to meet her after all.
"Issue the restraint..."
"Restraint depressurize."
The bags deflated.
"Welcome to low Arb orbit,"
said the voice, in an altogether different tone. My head and torso were now free to move about the HTU, but my arms and legs were still taped and foamed. I got busy with that box cutter. It was slow going at first, but soon hunks of foam and snarls of tape were flying out of the Magnifique, drifting away, keeping station in my general vicinity. Eventually, because of their low mass and high drag, they'd re-enter and burn up. Until then, they'd make a lot of visual clutter to confuse the geometers. Speaking of clutter, I was beginning to see brilliant specks of light around me. There were two kinds, millions of tiny sparkles, strips of chaff sent up on other missiles, and dozens of large, steady beacons. Some of the latter were near enough that my eyeballs, gradually resuming their former shape, could resolve them as disks or moons. Depending on where they, I, and the sun were situated, some looked like full moons, some like new ones, others somewhere in between. There was a half moon off to my right, steadily getting larger as my orbit and it converged. It was a metallized polyballoon, 500 feet across, sent up in the same missile barrage as I. By measuring its apparent size against the reticle on my face mask, I was able to estimate its distance, about 2 miles. This must be the one I was supposed to make for. Feeling around inside the arm stumps, I got my left hand on the trackball and my right on the stick. They were dead until I uttered another voice command and confirmed it by flicking a switch. This brought the Monufique's thrusters under my control. Up to now, the built-in guidance system had been managing them. And assuming that the nearby balloon was the one that I was supposed to be aiming for, it seemed to have done a respectable job. But it had no eyes, no brain by which it could home in on the balloon. And as long as the geometers kept jamming our nav satellites, it could only get me so close. From here on, my eyes would have to be the sensors and my brain the guidance system. I gave the trackball the tiniest rotation just to verify that the system was working, and the thrusters spat blue light and spun me around to a new attitude. I got my bearings, squared Arb's horizon below me, figured out which way was southeast, the direction of my orbital travel, made a mental calculation, thought about it one more time for good measure, and gave the joystick a shot in two directions. The Magnifique hit me with a 1-2 punch. Other than that, nothing terrible happened, and I liked what the balloon was now doing in my visual field, so I was tempted to repeat. But I thought better of it. That was how we had frequently got into trouble in the video game, by doing too much of the right thing. I had a long-distance wireless transceiver, for use only in emergencies. I left it switched off. When the balloon was close enough for the short-range system to work, I said, "Reticule scan." And a few moments later, the suit came back with, "Network joined," drowned out by Saman's voice,
"How was that for a ride?"
"I want my money back," I said, and suppressed a feeling of wild joy that came over me on hearing his, anyone's, voice. Glancing down at a display below my face mask, actually projected into my eyeballs so that it looked that way, I saw icons for myself, Saman, and Fra Gratho. But as I was looking, Esma's face and then Jules were tacked on. I looked around to see two other Monufiques converging on us. They were flying in improbably close formation. Actually, one of them, Esma, was towing the other. "I grappled Jules. He was drifting," Esma said. Fortunately, I had grown accustomed to the Veiler's habit of modest understatement. I had only just managed to get here alone. In the same time, Esma had tracked someone else, maneuvered to snag him, and brought him home.
"Jules, what's up? You okay? Is this what passes for a joke on La Terre?" Saman asked.
"I locked him out of the reticule," Esma said. "He was speaking incoherently of cheese." 20 minutes to line of sight," said an automated voice, referring to the time when the Davin Ernud would be able to see us. The balloon now was huge in my vision, and I could see Saman hovering to one side of it in his Magnifique, Gratho and his about 50 feet away. Both looked strangely colorful and fuzzy, like toddlers' toys. The Magnifiques and the other non-human payloads that had been sent up at the same time were surrounded by unruly clouds of fibrous netting that had been crammed into sealed capsules for the ride up, but that had popped open once we had hit orbit and expanded to 10 times their former volume. We looked like drifting red pom-poms. "You guys performed the star check?" I asked.
"Yes,"
said Gratho.
"But I invite you to verify our results."
I used the trackball to nudge myself around until I could see the vaguely circular constellation that outlined the hoplite's shield, and compared its position to those of Arb and of the balloon. This was a simple way of assuring that when our orbit took us around to where telescopes on the Davin Ernud might be able to see us, the balloon would be between us and them. By now, the geometers must know that something big was afoot. We had timed it, though, in such a way that Arb,
had blocked their view of the 200 missile launch. That was soon to change. Our orbit was almost perfectly circular. Its eccentricity, a measure of how unround it was only 0.001, and it skimmed just above the atmosphere, at an altitude of 100 miles. It took us around Arb once every hour and a half. The Dabun-Urnud's orbit was more elliptical, and its altitude ranged between 14 and 25,000 miles. It took 10 times as long, about 15 hours, to make one revolution. Imagine two runners circling a pond, one staying so close to the shore that his feet got wet, the other maintaining a distance of half a mile. The one on the inside would lap the other 10 times for every circuit made by the other. Whenever we were lapping the Dabun-Urnud, they could look down and see us against the backdrop of Arb. Soon, though, we would scoot around behind the planet and be lost to their view for anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour. We had launched during one of those intervals of privacy. Now it was halfway over. Why hadn't we simply launched to a higher orbit? Because our patched-together launch system wasn't capable of dumping that much energy into a payload. In a few minutes, when the Dabun-Urnud got line of sight to the cloud of stuff that had just been flung into orbit by those 200 missiles, they'd see a few dozen balloons salted through a nebula of radar-jamming chaff, strips of metallized poly, hundreds of miles across, and rapidly getting bigger as orbits diverged. The chaff would make long-wavelength surveillance, radar, useless. They'd have to look at us in shorter wavelengths, light, which would necessarily mean sorting through a very large number of phototypes, looking for anything that wasn't a balloon or a strip of chaff. If we did this right, then even if they did manage to collect all of those pictures and inspect them in a reasonable span of time, they'd still see nothing, because we and all of our stuff would be hiding behind one of the balloons. But this implied that a lot would have to happen in the next 20 minutes. I became so preoccupied that I almost forgot Jessery's first piece of advice, don't miss the scupper. The first spasms in my throat seized my attention, though, and I was able to lunge forward and bite down on the rubber orifice just in time. My breakfast was vacuumed away and freeze-dried into a waste bag somewhere. I returned to the task at hand. Fortunately, and a bit surprisingly, the big pill didn't come up. It must still be down in my gut somewhere, sending temperature and other biochemical data to the suit's processors. After that, anyway, I felt better, and didn't throw up again for almost 10 seconds. By getting there first, Saman had appointed himself Glommer, which meant that his job was to keep station under the balloon and secure the incoming payloads into a single haphazardly connected mass. Payload number one was Jules Verne Durand. Esma towed him in and hit the brakes. Her magnifique stopped, but Jules kept going, like a trailer jackknifing on an icy road. She had to backthrust once more as the Lateran's rig tried to jerk her forward. As Gratho hovered watchfully, wondering whether this was an emergence, Saman maneuvered closer, then spun in place. A long, slender probe snapped out from his magnifique, stretched across 20 feet of space in an eye blink, and buried itself in the mass of red fuzz surrounding Jules' rig.
Nailed it!
Jules was now stretched between him and Esma.
Feel free to detach.
De-grappling, Esma reported. I'll try to find additional payloads. Her jets flared, and the probe connecting her to Jules' fuzzball slid free. Thus did Saman begin his work as Glommer. The rest of us were getters, meaning we'd move around using the maneuvering thrusters, latch onto payloads that drifted near, and bring them to the Glommer. I spun my rig around to look for any incoming payloads. Humans, of whom there ought to have been 11, were color-coded red. The tender and its little nuke plant were also red, since we'd soon die without them. In addition, there were 50 magnifiques carrying cargo. Their fuzzballs were blue. Their contents were interchangeable. Each contained some water, some food, some fuel, and some other stuff we'd need. That's because we didn't expect to recover all of them. When I looked around, I saw what seemed like an impossibly huge number of red and blue fuzzballs, all drifting in the general vicinity. My brain told me, flat out, that rounding them all up was impossible. It was a disaster. but the very least I could do was head for the nearest red one and make sure that whoever it was had survived the launch and was conscious. I began to line up for a rendezvous, but I'd barely begun to move before I saw maneuvering jets flash. Jezri's icon came up on my display.
I'm good,
he announced impatiently.
Go look for something that can't take care of itself.
Beyond him, a blue payload was coming in. It was in the correct plane, but its orbit was a little too eccentric, so it was losing altitude, probably doomed to re-enter and burn up in a few minutes. I got myself spun around facing forward, i.e. in the direction that I and all of this other stuff were moving in our orbits around Arb, and then made myself vertical, so that the soles of my feet were pointed at Arb and its horizon was parallel to a certain line drawn across my face mask. The payload was slowly falling through my visual field. I used the stick to thrust backwards, slowing myself down. The payload stopped falling, which meant I was now in the same doomed orbit that it was. A little more maneuvering took me to within 20 feet of the thing. I was distracted for a moment by more visual clutter. A red payload, tumbling across my visual field from left to right, sideswiped a blue one. My eye was drawn to it. The red and the blue had stuck together. I reckoned it was one of the other cell members doing what I was doing, but if so, they weren't using a grapnel, just holding onto the net with a skele-hand or something. The red and the blue payload had merged into a slowly rotating binary star. I saw no sign of thrusters being fired, no evidence that the person was even conscious.
I think we might have someone in trouble here, an inadvertent collision, I reported.
I see what you see and I'm coming to investigate, said Arcibalt.
I'm a little closer, I offered, turning my head around and seeing Arcibalt on his way in.
No, he said. Go ahead and take the payload you've got.